Okay, we are today going to begin the doctrine of the Sabbath. I think after this is Passover, and then after that is the Holy Days. So this kind of Sabbath, Passover, and the Holy Days section that we're in right now, our fundamentals of belief, we're moving right along. I think we will get everything done as we move through here. So this is a very defining doctrine, as you know. Every 7 days, our life is defined by keeping a Sabbath rest. In the church, we believe that the Sabbath is a binding part of the law of God, the fourth commandment, and it's a defining aspect of our church life, isn't it? When we cease from work and everything and kind of orient your week to that, you've all grown up keeping the Sabbath in the church, and so it's a very, very defining part of our life and a very important doctrine. At the beginning of the United Church of God 22 years ago, it was when the Worldwide Church of God finally pulled the plug on the Sabbath that we moved as we did to begin the and form the United Church of God. I think I've told you the story of my being challenged by a man one time as to why it took getting to the fourth commandment before we in the United Church of God moved, when the other three had been trashed before that, which was a good question. But nonetheless, this is how things developed at that time. And when that happened in December of 1994, in a sermon that was given by the then pastor general in Big Sandy, Texas, saying essentially you can play golf on the Sabbath, you can do what you want on the Sabbath, and then we knew that the finger had been pulled out of the dike and it was all over, okay? So a few months later, we formed the United Church of God. And so we spent really a good chunk of time in our initial months redefining this particular teaching. We actually leaned quite heavily, several of us did, and even quite a number in the ministry, on a Seventh-day Adventist instructor at the Adventist University up here in Michigan called Andrews University, which is one of the Adventist universities in America, a man by the name of Samuel Bakioki, who had written a book. His doctrinal dissertation was on the Sabbath. We have a copy of that book in the library. It's a very good book, and that really helped us. In fact, I invited Dr. Bakioki to my congregation in Indianapolis to lecture to us, or to speak to the church in 1995, in the early days of the United Church of God, just to help us kind of rebuild our doctrinal base. This was one of the critically important ones that we had. So we'll spend a couple of classes going through it here and the overview of it all. There's a lot to say and probably not cover everything that we have, but it's the 10th one on the list. And here's what it says. We believe that the seventh day of the week is the Sabbath of the Lord our God. On this day we are commanded to rest from our labors and worship God, following the teachings and example of Jesus, the apostles, and the New Testament church. So it's a rather comprehensive statement that takes in everything in terms of the seventh day teaching that we have about the Sabbath, that primarily that we are commanded to rest from our labors. That's kind of the operative phrase there, and worship God. Rest and worship are two components of the Sabbath that we do. We rest physically in that we stop our work from which we gain our income, and don't mow the yard on the Sabbath. We don't trim trees on the Sabbath. We stop our customary work to begin the Sabbath, and then we also have, there's a spiritual component to that idea of rest. We will talk about that, in that we have a relationship with God that we develop by worshiping God. So there's a physical rest, but there's also as important, and perhaps you could argue even more important, the concept of a spiritual rest. And I'll be real blunt with you up front. If we focus only on the physical aspect of the Sabbath to the detriment of the spiritual rest, then we will not fully understand the full dimension, all the dimensions of the Sabbath and what it is to be for mankind. Another blunt statement, I think I'll just speak for myself, but I know that other ministers would say the same. It was by reading Dr. Bakayoki's writings on the Sabbath, and he's a Seventh-day Adventist, that a lot of deeper understanding about the Sabbath was opened up to me, and I would highly recommend his book, From Sabbath to Sunday. Again, the copy's on the shelf in the library, and you would be well served to dip into it and look into the comprehensive exposition that he gives on the topic of the Sabbath. The Seventh-day Adventist Church has been around a lot longer than the United Church of God. Has Mr. Antion talked about the Adventist Church in his comparative religion class to you? Okay, is that coming up, I suppose? Julie?
What's the name of the book?
From Sabbath to Sunday, I believe. It's a blue book. It's in there. Dr. Bakayoki also did some, because of his contact with us and our keeping the holy days, he did a lot of work on the holy days too, and wrote two books on the holy days. Though he did not embrace them in the same way that we do, as, of course, Adventists, they do not keep the holy days. But he did two other books of historical worth and treatment on the holy days as well. I think it's From Sabbath to Sunday. And he wrote that as his doctrinal dissertation, studying at the Vatican under the auspices of the Roman Catholic Church. He had access to all of their archives, and he documented the whole story and history of the Sabbath quite well in that book, but he was given his doctorate on the Sabbath essentially by a Roman Catholic institution at Rome, which is interesting, and that's another interesting story in and of itself. Okay? All right, so I've got to make sure I get this right here. New computer, new things. Webster's New Universal Unabridged Dictionary from 1983, article on the Sabbath, says, the day set apart in the fourth commandment of the Decalogue, meaning the Ten Commandments, to be observed as a day of rest from all secular labor or employment. Correct. This was originally the seventh day of the week, Saturday, as the day on which God rested from the work of creation. And this day is still observed by the Jews and some Christians as the Sabbath. So that's quite an interesting definition coming from Webster's Unabridged Dictionary of 1983, stating an obvious that can be confirmed in history that the seventh day of the week biblically is and always was and always is today Saturday, and still observed by Jews and some Christians. We are not the only Christian church. I've mentioned the Adventists. There's the Church of God Seventh Day. There's a group called the Church Seventh-day Baptists and other groups that will keep the Sabbath day. You'll find a mixture. Most don't keep the holy days. So that's interesting as well, and the reasons for that. Church of God Seventh Day, which has its, we have a connection with back in our early days of Mr. Armstrong and the church, they don't keep the holy days. The Adventists don't as well. Adventists, interesting, they keep the Sabbath, but they'll keep Christmas. They're Trinitarian. They will not keep the Passover in most cases. Some Adventists might keep an annual Passover. Most of them keep a quarterly, and some will keep it every month. Some will keep it whenever they want to. We rented from an Adventist church in Indianapolis for a number of years for a church hall. The overseeing minister of the church, he would take Passover with a Baptist. He would take a communion with a Baptist or an Orthodox, and with his own Adventist church, he didn't really care. He was quite ecumenical. You will find Adventists to be pretty well across the board. But they're defined in their name as the Seventh-day Adventists. Now, this next statement here we should spend a minute on about the Sabbath. This is a very important point. It says that we worship God by observing the Sabbath. The Sabbath is not an end. It is a means to an end. Okay? We use, quote, Romans 1, verse 25, where Paul talks about the state of the world at his time, mankind, and those that had rejected God, saying that they worship and serve God the creature or the creation more than the creator. And that principle that Paul talks about in Romans 1:25 applies to the Sabbath. And this is a very important point that we should note up front, that the Sabbath is not to be worshiped. It is the day on which we do worship God, as He commands and in the way that He lays out in His Word. One of the pitfalls of legalism or a fundamentalist approach to Scripture, which we would identify with a fundamentalist approach, but it can be that you can adopt a very legalistic approach to many forms of worship. And when it comes to the Sabbath, we want to be careful that we don't worship the Sabbath day. In Judaism especially, the Sabbath day among a very Orthodox Jew becomes the point of worship, just like Torah becomes a point of worship. They will speak of that in holy terms, not really understanding that it is God that is worshipped. And you know, you can play with words back and forth, but this happens especially when it comes to how we observe the Sabbath and approach matters. So we have been, this has been an accusation that some leveled against us 22 or more years ago in our former association and friends and peers, as they had embraced a different teaching that did away with the law, and particularly the Sabbath. One of the arguments used, well, you worship, if you want to keep the Sabbath that strictly, then you're worshiping the Sabbath, and you're not worshiping Christ, or you're not worshiping God. And it became an argument that it tripped up a lot of people if they were not grounded in that. And sometimes people begin to think, well, I guess he's right. I worship the day more than I worship God. Therefore, the conclusion would have been, and was in some cases, you can worship God on any day. You can worship God any day that you choose. First day, third day, whatever. All days. One of the most insidious of the arguments that was rolled out against the Sabbath in that period was that under the new covenant, there is no time, or there is no holy time. All time is holy. All time is holy. As a result of the sacrifice of Christ, therefore, you can worship God whenever you want, which in pure raw human nature terms comes out to be that you won't worship God on any day because that's what human nature does. But that was an argument that tripped, that frankly was the argument that tripped up a lot of people. All time is holy under the new covenant. Have I told you about the Maginot Line explanation of all of this? Yeah. All right, let's take 2 minutes of an excursus on this. Anybody know what the Maginot Line was? Tim, what is the Maginot Line historically?
It's a wall. It was a wall that was a defensive wall that was built in France right after World War I to help make sure the Germans wouldn't invade again.
Yeah, World War I, Germans rolled all over Europe, including France. And finally, they got beat back. And in order to keep that from happening again, they created this line of defenses and fortresses and gun emplacements all across France, kind of like this, up through Belgium. Here's France down here. Here's Germany up here. And these were permanent concrete encased guns, all pointed toward Germany, to keep the German troops from coming in. It was called the Maginot Line, M-A-G-I-N-O-T. Well, what happened? The German Blitzkrieg of 1939, when World War II began, instead of Germans coming straight down here, they said, all right, we'll come out over here. And that's what they did. They went around the Maginot Line and invaded France again, and as well as Belgium and Netherlands and all the Low Countries over here. And that proved to be ineffective. So what we did in the church through the years, this is where this applies, we created, I think, our own Maginot Line of defenses to defend our faith on the Sabbath day, particularly. In my college-inspired Bible that I took inspired margin notes in, I know I have one page devoted to proofs of the Sabbath. 7-point proof of the Sabbath. All right? And we had articles, and we had teaching and sermons and sermonettes through 30-some-odd years of Radio Worldwide Church of God experience proving the Sabbath. We had booklets, we had articles, we had correspondence courses, sermons, all these things given, proving 7 points here, 3 points there. We had it down. Nobody was going to deceive us on the Sabbath day. On comes 1994, 95, the so-called New Covenant theology, and they roll out a different attack. Instead of taking us out on all the proofs that we had there, they circled around and they said, there's no holy time. All time's holy under the new covenant with Christ's death. All time is holy. That was one of the most insidious of the arguments that was used, and it tripped up a lot of people. And they just overnight started just abandoning the Sabbath and so many of the other points of teaching of the truth that we have. And it was amazing. It really was. And there's a lot of other factors that kind of worked into that, but bottom line, when it comes to the Sabbath, yes, we must prove it doctrinally from the Scriptures, but the ultimate proof is going to come as we observe it and experience the rest, the spiritual rest of the Sabbath and the benefit of the Sabbath that comes from not only keeping it, resting physically, but through keeping it and worshiping God, fellowshipping, and looking at it and understanding it as what it is indeed, and that is a spiritual relationship that we develop with God through the Sabbath that develops a love for the truth. That point of the truth on the Sabbath as well as all the other points of the truth. And one of the things I've noted through the recent, subsequent years since 1995, in conversations I've had with other ministers and many, many members, you either love to keep the Sabbath, Feast of Tabernacles, any point of God's law, as the psalm says, oh, how love I thy law. It is my meditation. And we sing that, remember? It's one of our hymns. Oh, how love I thy law. We must come to love that, the law of God, the way of God, and the Sabbath being one part of it. And internalize it. In other words, it is written on our heart by the Holy Spirit. You and I have to move beyond notes in our Bible and point proof here, point proof there when it comes to all of God's way, but on this one especially, so that we truly do love to keep it, and we could not imagine a life without keeping it. And if so, we realize that our lives would be completely different. We would be actually completely different people. So it's critically important that we come back to we worship God and we don't worship the day. Let's look at the outline of the class that we're going to go through. We're going to talk about the origin of Sabbath. We're going to talk about the Israel and the Sabbath, how that applies. We're going to talk about the next point, Sabbath in the Old Testament, Christ and the Sabbath, and the Sabbath in the New Testament. So that's kind of the outline of where we're going, and I'll jump off here and there probably at other various points and make the comments or the statements that I like to make as we talk about the Sabbath. But let's go ahead and look at the origin of the Sabbath here. Created by God at the very beginning, Genesis chapter 2. On the seventh day, God ended his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. And God blessed the seventh day, and he sanctified it. So in the very act of the creation account of Genesis chapter 2, we find that after 6 days of work and the labor required to fashion and form the earth, including man on the sixth day, the seventh day becomes then a part of the creation. It begins here. This is one of the things that we understand. This is the first scripture, obviously, that talks about the Sabbath. And in this, it also is one of the more, a very important one. One reason being that it shows us that the Sabbath is not connected with any subsequent covenant relationship that God makes with either the nation of Israel or any individual, whether it was Noah or David or Abraham or the collective covenant that he made at Mount Sinai with the children of Israel. The Sabbath predates all of those covenants. All right? And while the Sabbath may have been a part of the Sinai covenant with the Ten Commandments, it was put there as part of the covenant, but it predates that covenant, which is a critically important point to understand in terms of a legal structure and seeing how the scriptures lay out the Sabbath here. It was part of creation. It was created then by God resting from His work, which He had done, which is where we fall in on this. One of the things that I had read a few years ago, and it really helped to kind of make the Sabbath, it casts it in a totally new light for me. It was a writing on the Sabbath by a renowned Jewish scholar. And I forgot the gentleman's name. I don't have it in my notes here. I've got his book on my Kindle. But he coined the term about, as he talks about the Sabbath, he says the Sabbath, he calls it a temple in time. A temple in time. And I like that. All right? And it's here that we see with the beginning of the Sabbath that I think we get the basic understanding how this is. A temple is where God resides. The temple of the Bible, first the tabernacle in the wilderness, and then the temple Solomon built, and then we'll just stay right there because the second temple has no record of God's presence actually being there. But it did have a Holy of Holies, but we don't see that the presence of God came down upon the second temple like it did the first temple. But that's where God dwelt among men, in and through that temple and all the sacrifices and the rituals regarding that. And we don't have a temple today. But we do have this day where God rested and blessed it, and by His presence and His blessing, it is sanctified or set apart, which is what the term sanctified means. And when we keep that day and we rest from our labor, and then we labor spiritually in that we, through prayer, through Bible study, through fellowship, through extra focus, and we kind of move and close the books on the work of our life, and then we focus on a spiritual rest and we prepare ourselves, as the Sabbath comes to us, literally, I like to think of it this way myself, that we enter into a temple or the presence of God, a holy place, but it is in time. God is outside time. He's not bound by time or space. But through the Sabbath, as we fellowship with God and we observe it, we enter into a different frame and reference and should work toward that. And it's a spiritual work and labor toward that as we fellowship with God and in spiritually and through our contact with one another, formal service and otherwise. And it's a temple in time. And I think to the degree that you can develop that thinking as you approach the Sabbath, it helps to then move us away from, you know, watching that clock, either at the beginning or the end, and kind of living according to that clock on the Sabbath. And we naturally becomes a part of it. We're ready when it happens. And when it's over, our mind turns to other things. Personal preference. I don't look at the clock that much. I don't worry about the clock on the Sabbath day. All right, if you do, that's fine. I just don't, you know, it's dark, Sabbath's here. And when it's dark again, it's over. I just, you know, I have a general sense of things, obviously, but I don't worry about it. And I don't obsess. I don't try to figure out, you know, okay, all right, here we go. All right, Sabbath's over, turn that television on. Or, you know, boom, here we go. I just don't like to live that way, but as I keep the Sabbath. To me, it's a more natural approach. It's for me at least a prevention against legalism. As you can tell, I don't like legalism. Okay. The word rested, as it is described here, comes from the Hebrew Shabbat. There are two Hebrew words which are very similar. One's a noun, the other is a verb. One means to rest, and the other means the rest. So it is a literal time, a noun in that sense, but we do something on it, and that is we rest physically, and we rest spiritually, and enter into a spiritual rest that changes our focus mind as well. In the New Testament, the Greek word for Sabbath is sabbaton, and it's translated as a solemn rest or a day of solemn rest. In both the Hebrew and the Greek origins, we have the idea of resting or ceasing from our labor, and that's the key to understanding the Sabbath. And you technically look at what the words mean, and it does mean a day of solemn rest where we are to rest. Even the Webster's Dictionary definition that we put up at the beginning shows that. And one of the things I've found is that the less we try to play with what that means and some of the questions that can come up, as to, well, can I do this? Or is this permissible? The less we approach it that way, the better we are. There are certain legitimate questions and things to consider and get counsel on, but I would encourage you to get to the point where you can answer the questions that might come up in your life on your own, because of your understanding of what the technicalities of the words mean and the command and the law means. But beyond that, because you love the Sabbath and you have personally experienced in your life the benefit, spiritual benefit, that comes from keeping that day. If you keep a day of rest, you're automatically going to experience the physical benefit. I mean, everybody needs a day off. And even business people know that. I've run across some very interesting business-related books that talk about the need for a rest. In other words, don't work 7 days a week. Take a day off. Now, they're not talking about keeping the seventh day, but they understand the principle that you can't just keep going on and on every single day, driving in sales and whatever your occupation might be, and just working without any stop. You've got to stop, and as one book put it, you've got to let the juice flow down your mouth, your on the outside of your throat, literally. You ever bit into a ripe peach? And it just, the juice, you can't keep it all inside, and the juice just comes on down. Not the peaches you get at Kroger, but a real ripe peach that comes off the tree right out of South Carolina. And it's juicy, and it's late July, and you bite into it, and right down through there. And you just let it happen. And you say, oh, that tastes so good. It tastes like a real peach. And that the book was using that as kind of an approach toward a day of rest. And it's pretty good if you want, you know, that's a pretty good description of the Sabbath. That's when you kind of let that peach juice just flow over it. It just is so good. It's so refreshing. There's nothing like the taste of a fresh peach and the juice going down, and you don't care. You just kind of relax. And you lap it up all that you can and wipe it off, and you don't worry about it. Because you're not uptight, you're not having to keep up appearances. That was the way that the business book put it, but I thought that was one of the better explanations to an approach toward the Sabbath, to let the juice run down your chin. And that's pretty good. But as we do that, we understand what the heart and core of it is. In regard to the nation of Israel, the Sabbath day came to be repeated to Israel in a very forceful fashion when they left Egypt. Genesis defines the Sabbath day And we see that given to man there. And God doesn't always repeat with every story from Genesis. And Noah kept the Sabbath. And Abraham did this or whatever. It is shown to be a part of those who follow God. When we come down to the book of Exodus, and particularly in chapter 16 of Exodus, it is brought back into the mind of the Israelites in Egypt who have forgotten it by virtue of being in slavery to the Pharaoh there, and they have to be told that tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath. This is after they come out and after the miracles of the Exodus. In chapter 16 of Exodus, this is where it is forcefully repeated, and there is the story there of somebody not going or not paying attention to it and going out and gathering on the Sabbath, and he is dealt with in a very direct way. And so that has to be recognized and understood. In chapter 20 of Exodus, as a part of the covenant at Sinai, the Sabbath day is included in that covenant. 6 days you will labor and do all of your work. And again, God says to Israel to remember the Sabbath, and that gives certainly the understanding that it was something going all the way back to creation when it began. So the remember was a continuous, was a requirement or a memory of the continuous requirement from keeping the Sabbath at the beginning. The penalty for breaking the Sabbath was laid out in Exodus chapter 35, where 6 days you will work. Work will be done, but on the seventh day, there shall be to you a holy day, a Sabbath of rest to the Lord. Whosoever does work therein shall be put to death. And so in the process of the covenant, the relationship that God was establishing with Israel, not only on a personal level, but on a community-wide level, the forcefulness with which this was put into the actual day-to-day workings of the people of Israel in the wilderness to be then translated into the permanent settlement that they would have on in the land is put down here that it would be holy and a time of rest. Yes, along with Genesis 2, Exodus 16 takes place before they come to Sinai, and the commandments are given as part of the covenant and chapter 24 of Exodus, where they formally ratify the covenant. The Sabbath is shown to be a part of the spiritual law, which then is codified in the commandments and becomes then part of that covenant relationship. It's a matter of understanding that the covenant God made with the nation at Mount Sinai included the spiritual law, which has always been in effect. We used to have an article in Worldwide showing, I think, all 10 of the commandments before Exodus chapter 20, all right, showed that the commandments were in effect before they were codified in the covenant at Sinai. And it was that covenant that changed or was done away, as the book of Hebrews shows, but the law, the spiritual law within that covenant still exists. That's how you understand the distinction there. And unfortunately, that got lost in translation 22 or more years ago for a number of reasons, and people just abandoned it right there. But it's one of the arguments that is used. But when you understand that, then you couple that with Paul's laws about the law being spiritual, holy, just, and good, then you have a whole view from Genesis all the way through to understand what the law is and how it relates to the various covenants that are made. Okay? All right, let's move on. Israel and the Sabbath, it was a sign. Chapter 31 and verse 13 of Exodus. Surely my Sabbaths shall you keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations. So if this was made as a sign here in verse 13 and verse 17. An additional comment is made by God. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested. Does this make it only for Israel? if you focused only on these verses, then you might see that as a valid statement or argument that, yes, it's only for Israel. But it does say that it is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever, which keeps it open-ended. But when you, again, keep the view of what the New Testament says about the Sabbath, particularly Hebrews chapter 4, then you have an understanding that this Sabbath was not just for Israel or for the Jew. The Sabbath is for all mankind. It is for all man, as the comment by Christ is in Mark 2:27, where he says that the Sabbath was made for man. And that is not just speaking to the descendants of Abraham, but for all of mankind. Yeah, this might be a good place to make this one comment because of the statement here in verse 17, a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. Of course, you understand that Israel, the children of Israel, included all the descendants of Jacob, and Jacob had 12 sons that made up Israel. Jacob put his name, which was changed to Israel, he did put it upon the sons of Manasseh, or the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. But Israel, taken as a whole, included all of the tribes, all of the descendants of the sons of Jacob. Today, as you look at the Sabbath and as you look at the people, the remnant of Abraham's children that are defined culturally in the world today, we're looking only at the Jews who do keep the Sabbath. At least the Orthodox, conservative Jews keep the Sabbath. And it is identified primarily with them. As the Webster Dictionary said, the Jews keep it, but also some other Christian churches keep it as well. But primarily, if you were to talk to people today, who keeps Saturday as a Sabbath, any literate person is going to say, well, of course the Jews do. All right, it's associated with them. And some people, to follow the line of argument, will say, well, that then the Sabbath was only given to the Jews. Or that would not be a totally correct statement because we see that it's a sign between God and the children of Israel, which includes all of the descendants of Jacob. But for people's frame of reference today, it's the Jews. And down through history, the Jewish people, the remnant of the Jews, have continued. They have an identity. They keep the Sabbath. And they alone, of all of the children of Israel, know, in a sense, who their father was and their history, and keep that Sabbath and are identified with it. Joseph is not, all right? Gad, Naphtali, and Reuben, and all the others, wherever they might be, are not identified with it because they've lost their identity, they've lost this identifying sign, and it's only to the Jews. The Jews are the ones, then, against whom we have this horrendous attitude called anti-Semitism, all right? Everybody knows what anti-Semitism is, right? I know I've mentioned it several times with you. Anti-Semitism, largely leveled against Jews, is a virulent hatred, persecution, antagonism toward Jews and things Jewish, all right? Any of you have ever been called a Jew because you keep the Sabbath or go to the Feast of Tabernacles? You're experiencing a mild form of anti-Semitism. Its worst form is the Holocaust, historically. Okay, I read a book a few years ago called The Gift of the Jews. I would recommend that book just to gain an understanding of a new view of things Abraham and Moses and the Jews. But the author of the book, Thomas Cahill, makes a statement in there as he talks about anti-Semitism. He talks about Mount Sinai and the covenant God made with Israel. And he's really talking about human nature. And he comes down and he identifies what I think is a true statement, and that is the root behind all anti-Semitism. It's not just a hatred of Jews and things Jewish, but Cahill says anti-Semitism is really a hatred against God. A hatred against God. And those awful 10, the Ten Commandments, that human nature, mankind, chafes against and has always chafed against historically, and not wanting. In Romans 1, Paul talks about the human condition that, quote, because they did not keep God in their knowledge. Yeah. Because they did not keep God in their knowledge, he gave them over to a reprobate mind. Human nature has not wanted to acknowledge not only that there is a God, they don't want any knowledge of God at all in their life telling them what to do. That's the most extreme portion of it. Its most extreme and odious expression historically has come against the Jews because they, of all the children of Israel, given this covenant, this sign, continue to keep what point of the law that defines them? The Sabbath. The Sabbath. You don't identify them with thou shalt not commit adultery or thou shalt not kill. You identify the Sabbath against them. I say mankind as a whole. And they keep it. And they have kept it against all the persecution, the Holocaust, the pogroms that have been leveled against them historically for 2,500 years. The first Holocaust or the first proposed Holocaust is in the book of Esther, where Haman is building the scaffold. And he's got this plot to kill all the Jews in Persia. And you know who steps in? Esther. That beautiful story. That's the first recorded incident of a Holocaust in the making or anti-Semitism. And you just march through history and it's all over the place. But at the heart of anti-Semitism is a hatred of God and particularly the fourth commandment. And that's why it's been leveled against the Jews because they have maintained their identity through the years. In Revelation chapter 12, at the end of chapter 12, when Satan goes to make war against the remnant of her seed, being the church, it says that two identifying factors of those that Satan goes out seeking to hit are those who have the commandments of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. Look at that at the very end of chapter 12 of Revelation. The commandments of God will define the people of God who will be persecuted at that moment at the time of the end. And the Sabbath is going to be a part of that. So, the only part of the children of Israel that's kept it are the Jews. And anti-Semitism has been given to them as a cross to bear, unfortunately. And not the best choice of words, I suppose. But that's where it is, Charlie.